You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 7th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme, we'll get the latest from China's annual National People's Congress as President Xi Jinping tries to steady the struggling economy. And then...
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and the distinct honour to present to you the President of the United States.
That was last year, but what's in store for tonight? President Biden prepares to make his third State of the Union address in Congress, but will it be his last? Then the latest business news, and we'll check in on Madrid's Arco Art Fair. Plus, who takes the biscuit in our global baking ranking?
The trick is, no more than three. You know, control yourself, but have it every day.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. First to China, where this week the annual National People's Congress is being held in Tiananmen Square's Great Hall of the People. The NPC is the world's largest legislative body, with almost 3,000 members, and sits for 2 weeks voting on legislation and personnel assignments. This year, the focus has inevitably been on China's economy, still struggling with a pandemic hangover and a property crisis which could have global ramifications. Our guest today, who's covered plenty of these, is the BBC's former China correspondent, Robin Brandt. Robin, thank you for joining us in the studio. Firstly, before we discuss this week's, what is covering these unique events like?
Well, look, you go along with hundreds of other journalists, obviously predominantly Chinese, but lots of international journalists as well. It's a heavily choreographed event where you are told what to go. Many of the people there are told what to say. And on the security side, frankly, it's a nightmare. But this is an annual showcase for China's Communist Party. And they want the world to see. They want the world to see China's democracy in action. They want the people of China to see the process of making its laws and seeing its leaders. But frankly, you don't really get much insight in terms of opportunities to talk to people or ask insightful questions. Frankly, you're there to shoot the event. Occasionally, you can vox pop people going in, but that in itself can be perilous at times. But it's a heavily choreographed event, but it's hugely important for China's Communist Party because it's an illustration to China's 1.4 billion people, if nothing else, that they are doing their job. They're passing those laws. They're approving those people for those jobs. But you'll hear this phrase a lot, that rubber stamp parliament. I mean, certainly not in the Xi Jinping era do you ever get a moment where what Xi Jinping and the people around him want not happening.
And turning to this week's event, we've seen the big announcement, China setting that ambitious growth target of 5%, the kind of growth Western leaders can only dream of. What did you make of the announcement and is it attainable?
Well, it's utterly unsurprising because it fits with the trend of what we've heard from Xi Jinping and the country's former premier, that was Li Keqiang up until last year, who is nominally the person in charge of steering China's economy. Remember, the world's second largest economy. The key thing in the target set for the year ahead is not just 5%, but the phrase around 5%. These things matter. It gives them some sense of wiggle room. But like I said, it fits in with the trend of predictions, of forecasts, of expectations on the party side. I mean, frankly, we always take these numbers on China's economic performance with a massive dose of salt because there is opacity. It's always unclear the extent to which we can trust government numbers coming out of China. In all my reporting over the years, I've always given that huge caveat. There is much suspicion, much doubt around the number. And in fact, there are many who believe that technically China was in a recession last year. There's huge deflationary pressure. Consumer confidence is on the floor. You've talked about that problem we're seeing within the property market within China. So look, is it a real number? Frankly, we don't know. Was China in a technical recession last year? That's something they'll certainly never, ever admit. But it fits in with the trend around 5%. Crucially, that trend is of falling growth over recent years.
I'll come to property in a second, but in terms of other drags on the economy, there is this issue of huge youth unemployment as well and sort of things not quite getting back to normal after the pandemic. What do you think they're going to try and do to solve that issue?
Well, look, this is fascinating, and it is hugely problematic in terms of an issue that China's leaders need to face now, but also in terms of a strategic problem and some of the challenge that could bring in terms of unrest. What you don't want, particularly when you are a communist party more than 75 years into controlling China, is increasing numbers of intelligent, restless young people with not much to do. Youth unemployment, I think it's now standing at around a third, has been hugely problematic. And lots of that has come because, frankly, we've seen crackdowns, particularly on the tech sector, huge regulatory efforts to control the dominance of some of those big companies. And many of the people employed in those companies are young people, are young graduates. You know, my years in China and Shanghai, particularly after the pandemic, we spoke to numerous young graduates who were coming out who in the past who would have gone off to Tencent, they would have gone to Baidu, they would have gone on to Didi. That is not now happening. The culture is changing. I mean, what China needs to do is encourage more domestic consumer confidence and continue to encourage what Xi Jinping has referred to as the zeal of entrepreneurship. But at the same time, we're seeing efforts to deal with inequality within society, and we're seeing efforts to deal with those problems within the property sector. And much of that does mean as well that there is more of a regulatory push on the tech side, and that means there are fewer jobs going for younger people.
And in the past year, they've even told young people to sort of lower their expectations of what kind of jobs they'll be going into. But one thing they can't manage expectations on, really, is the property market. Premier Li Qiang himself, in his address, highlighted it as a potential danger. How significant a problem is it? And do you think that's got more of a prospect of causing civil disorder?
Yeah, I mean, it's a systemic problem that Li Qiang and Xi Jinping are determined to deal with. There's a political aspect to this, of course, and Xi Jinping in recent years has talked about the end of the speculative market in terms of residential property in China. He wants to see homes more regarded as somewhere that people live in, as opposed to somewhere that people invest in, particularly in the city that I lived in, Shanghai, where there was a huge boom in the property market. So we're seeing a big shift in terms of the political imperative, but also a big shift to deal with what was a systemic issue, which is there are far too many new homes and new properties being built in China. Many of them are empty. At the same time, in cities like Shanghai, Tianjin, Beijing, a huge speculative market that drove the price of property up. But the problem is there are many among the hundreds of millions of very wealthy Chinese middle class who put all their money into property. That's their main asset for investment. And they are now taking a big hit now as the prices of those properties have fallen. And that presents numerous problems for Chinese Communist Party leadership, because those people are agitated, they're angry, often they don't have much recourse. But the leadership has made it clear, they've got to adapt. In terms of moral hazard now, there are no more big bailouts. And that is a trend that has become quite clear over the last year in terms of what the government wants to do and where its sentiment is.
And what do you make of the decision this year to scrap the sort of traditional closing press conference that's been around for about three decades? I mean, was it a press conference as you and I would know one?
No, it's not a press conference in the sense that we've been to over the years. I mean, they come along, they talk to the media, including the international media. It's the only chance in a year where the country's premier, now Li Qiang, who is nominally in charge of the economy, nominally the country's number two leader, takes questions and gives answers. So in terms of a transparency, in terms of accountability, in terms of scrutiny, it was all we kind of had. And now it's gone. We don't quite know why Li Qiang has chosen to do that. He is a man supremely loyal to his boss, Xi Jinping, who appointed him last year. I mean, look, whether you went along and got the chance to ask a question and get an authentic, honest answer, well, you know, I never really felt that. But the fact that, in terms of the symbolism, in fact, the fact that now just that one single moment has gone shows you that China's leadership don't regard it as important. And frankly, maybe this year don't want to expose themselves to those questions about an economy that is in deep, deep trouble for now.
Robin Brandt, thank you. Now here's Monocle's Lillian Fawcett with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. A report from the Netherlands finds that an Israeli tank fired at a group of clearly marked journalists, killing a Reuters reporter in Lebanon in October. The Netherlands Organization for Applied Scientific Research had been asked by Reuters itself to evaluate data from the attack. The European Parliament's Trade Committee has agreed to grant Ukrainian food producers access to the European Union without tariffs for another year. Lawmakers approved the extension until 2025, despite protests by farmers in Europe, particularly in Poland. The UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron is in Berlin meeting with his German counterpart Annalena Baerbock, pushing for additional aid to Ukraine. The summit comes after an intelligence scandal that saw Germany reveal the participation of UK and French personnel on the ground in Ukraine. And a jury in the US state of New Mexico has found Hannah Gutierrez, armorer in the movie Rust, guilty of involuntary manslaughter after a fatal shooting on the set of the movie. The actor Alec Baldwin still faces potential charges of his own. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thanks, Lillian. Well, tonight, President Joe Biden will deliver the annual State of the Union address to Congress in what, after Super Tuesday, all but confirmed Trump as his opponent, will effectively be the launch of his re-election campaign. The event is a big opportunity for the president to speak directly to the American people after having ducked his messaging opportunities recently, like the Super Bowl interview. To discuss the potential power of the set piece event, I'm joined now by Natasha Lindstadt, Professor of Government at the University of Essex. Natasha, thank you for joining us. Firstly, Joe Biden's position in the polls is precarious. Can he do much tonight to claim a lead?
I don't know how much he can do just in one night to reclaim the lead, but he definitely has to project an image of confidence and capability and strength. So the State of the Union, of course, is just something the president from time to time should do, giving Congress information and recommending legislation and also trying to communicate to the public. But this isn't just part of his job. It's also essentially part of his campaign, although that's not what the State of the Union officially is supposed to be about. And I think you can't really separate the State of the Union from his campaign. And he's going to try to make the case that he is fit for office, that he's not too old. And then he's going to try to highlight some of the accomplishments of the administration. He'll probably try to take some credit for the economy, that the trajectory of the economy seems to be moving upwards, and he'll try to encourage lawmakers in particular to pass some key spending bills about Ukraine and the crisis at the border. And this is one of the issues that he's not polling that well on, the issue of immigration. And you, of course, have Donald Trump urging lawmakers to block action on this. So he's going to be trying to urge Congress to pass a bipartisan immigration bill.
And he does tend to do quite well when he goes off script somewhat. Last year, for instance, when he turned the tables on the Republicans like this.
Some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset. I'm not saying it's a majority. Let me give you, anybody who doubts it, contact my office. I'll give you a copy. I'll give you a copy of the proposal. That means Congress doesn't vote. Well, I'm glad to see you. No, I tell you, I enjoy conversion.
Well, that moment last year did a lot to highlight, one of the issues that you've mentioned there, the perceptions of his age and potentially any cognitive decline. He was pretty quick on his feet in setting that trap for Republicans. Does he need something else like that tonight?
I think he's going to focus on the most important issue of the election, which is freedom. That's a big part of his campaign. The Democrats are talking about freedom being on the ballot, the freedom to choose, the freedom to vote, freedom to love who you want, to go to work, school, wherever you want, to not be gunned down by someone with some kind of semi-automatic weapon. He's going to be trying to present himself as a bulwark, just protecting U.S. democracy against Trump. And he needs to sell this pretty clearly to the American public. And he'll probably also try to pivot in just at least rhetorically on the conflict in Gaza and about the massive toll on innocent civilians. So he has a lot that he has to do tonight besides just being able to appear fit and quick on his feet, as you mentioned, but also highlight how important this election is. And I think he tends to do pretty well with this. It's just that overall, the Democrats' strategy and campaign and ground game has been fairly weak thus far.
Mm. A tradition of these events is special guests. It seems both Alexei Navalny's widow Yulia and Ukrainian First Lady Olena Zelenska have turned down invitations. But the White House in the past hour has confirmed Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson will be attending and that the country will officially join NATO today. Is that something that the president can capitalize on, sort of the strength he's had when it comes to pushing back on Russia, the fact that he went to Kyiv himself in the last year, the only president or the last president in the last century to have gone to an active war zone?
I think it's important for him to talk about this, particularly the issue of NATO and all the different things that you mentioned, but just the fact that Trump has threatened not just that the U.S. wouldn't really be involved in NATO anymore. I know there's a congressional law that was passed that the U.S. can't officially leave NATO, but that Trump has threatened that if NATO countries don't pay up, that he would even encourage or actively encourage Russia to go after these countries. I think he needs to highlight the contrast here of how dangerous a Trump-led world order would be with Trump in power versus Biden's emphasis on multilateral action, on working with others. And I think it highlights by having the Swedish prime minister there. He's also going to highlight the fact that he's been a pro-labor union president, and Sean Fain is one of the other notable guests that's going to be in attendance, because he has to appeal to some of these working class voters, particularly in these swing states. So he'll try to highlight his foreign policy accomplishments, how dangerous the world has become, and his the fact that he's basically been one of the first U.S. presidents to attend a picket line, his commitment to labor issues.
And finally, just briefly, do you think we'll see him try to reach out to voters of the failed Republican candidates, particularly Nikki Haley voters tonight?
That's a really good question. I think if you look at the language, he tries not to alienate Republicans. I don't know if I would say he's directly reaching out to them or offering some sort of nugget that would appease them, maybe in talking about the need for some kind of bipartisan spending bill, the need for approving funding for Ukraine. Those were the types of issues that Haley's voters talked about, maybe taking a pragmatic approach to the economy. But I think he's going to be very careful to not alienate moderate Republicans with his speech, because he knows that that's one area of weakness that we saw with the primaries. In spite of the fact that Trump won very decisively, there were cracks in his support that we could see amongst those moderate Republicans or independent voters that are worried about a Trump presidency.
Natasha, thank you. That was the University of Essex's Professor Natasha Lindstadt. You're listening to Monocle Radio. Time now for a business update with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, who joins us from Dubai. Ewan, increasing speculation that the Bank of Japan will soon raise interest rates for the first time since 2007.
Hi, Vincent. Yeah, investors are betting that the March meeting of the Bank of Japan could finally be the one that sees the BOJ raise interest rates. Now, it's been 16 years since this last happened. Remember that while in Europe, America, and in fact, most of the world, we've seen interest rate hikes at real pace to combat our inflation problem, Japan still has a negative interest rate. It's the last remaining central bank with a negative rate, minus 0.1%. And the reason is that Japan has a growth problem. It's seen sluggish growth, little to no growth, for much of the past 30 years since the bubble burst. In fact, the fear of the BOJ and the fear of the Japanese government is not inflation, it's deflation. But there's hope now that that deflation period is behind Japan. Inflation currently 2.6% in Japan. That for Japan is a pretty high inflation rate. It's a number which many of us in the West would be very pleased to see. They did not have the massive inflation spike which we've had over the last couple of years. And inflation has been ticking along at a fairly low level. But now the BOJ has some confidence, we understand, that inflation is back nearer to its target of 2%. And that is rather, it's come from below zero. So they're trying to get it up to 2%. It's now 2.6%. And one of the missing parts of the picture, which seems to be coming into place, is that of wage growth. Now, Japan's largest labor union federation announced yesterday that the average demand made by its unions this year was 5.85%. That's the strongest pay demand in 30 years. In fact, the government's been implementing a number of measures to push this along, including tax breaks for companies that raise wages. So the hope now is that higher wages will finally outpace inflation, they'll drive consumption, and that will clear the path for the BOJ to raise rates.
And Ewan, a story from where you are in Dubai, a share offer is looking like it's going to be a success.
Yeah, the Dubai government's latest share offer has sold out within minutes. Investors have been rushing in to snap up shares in the city's public parking business. The company is called, rather obviously, Parkin, and it's in a fast-growing city of 3.5 million people, which basically runs on road transport. The public transport here is pretty rudimentary. A lot of people clearly think that running car parks, parking lots, is a good business. Now, the sale of a stake in Parkin will be the sixth privatisation by the Dubai government. It's all part of a plan unveiled at the end of 2021 to list 10 state-owned companies. The aim is to boost trading volumes on the stock market and match similar drives taking place in Abu Dhabi and in Riyadh. The Saudi stock market has really been booming recently. A lot of companies coming to market there. The Gulf, in fact, is currently experiencing something of an IPO boom, a share offer boom, with a number of offerings oversubscribed as investors focus in on the region. Parkin itself reckons that demand for public parking will grow by 60% over the next 10 years amid the fast-growing increase in Dubai's population. Although what that means will mean for the already bad traffic jams, well, I dread to think.
Ewan Potts, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. This week, the Monocle on Culture team is at the Arco Art Fair in Madrid, where Rob Bound, Monocle's senior correspondent, joins us from now. Rob, another week, another art fair. So what's different about Arco Madrid?
You've noticed, Finney. You've noticed. Yeah, there is a super proliferation of art fairs chasing us around the world, and we're chasing them around the world. What sets Arco aside and what makes it different is obviously its Spanish focus, and that then leaches out into the rest of the world as well. So it makes for kind of a rich curatorial display. I wrote a little thing for the Monocle Minute yesterday morning, in a similar vein that the curatorial stuff here is super strong, but there aren't blockbuster sales. It is much more, you're more likely to see museum curators and smaller time collectors than multi sort of $1 million blue chip galleries doing multi-million blue chip deals. So it's got a really nice vibe. And it's all kind of done with lashings of Spanish hospitality. The clink of glasses might be audible in the background, I have to say.
Well, you've mentioned that it's got a curatorial role. Can you give us a couple of examples?
Yeah, so I'm actually standing in a part of the fair which is about the Caribbean and about the kind of tide and flow of Caribbean influence, Spanish influence, American influence, European influence in and out of that really misunderstood region that is the Caribbean. Is it oceanic? Is it continental? You know, is it land? Is it sea? So there's a wonderful display. We spoke to the curator earlier today, which will be on the Monocle on Culture show next Monday. So that's a really strong show. And also some of the booths put on individual displays of artists rather than it being a sort of greatest hits of the art market style thing. So there's a really nice way that the curatorial kind of is not just a flag to plant in the ground. It sort of bears itself out walking around the show as well.
Spain and the Spanish language obviously have relationships across the world. How is this borne out in the work shown at the fair?
Well, you're right to point that out, Vinny. I mean, I've been walking around just before I came on the line, and I'm looking at galleries from Montevideo, from Buenos Aires, from Brasilia, from São Paulo, from Rio, from obviously the Spanish diaspora, as you might call it. So that's really great, and to get a kind of survey show of South American art, Latin American art in Europe is wonderful. It's something similar to what Art Basel does with its Miami Fair, which is obviously cheek by jowl with Latin American, a huge Latin American influence in that city. But here it really comes home to roost with the language and the new world coming home to roost in the old world, in old Europe, as it were.
And for anyone going along to the fair, what's the vibe they can enjoy? And have you spotted a piece of work that you'd like to put on your expenses and bring home?
Yeah, well, thanks for giving me the latitude to do that, Vinny. You'll be signing this off personally. I found at the Leandro Navarro gallery, which is just next to this Caribbean section. There's some wonderful Francisco Picabia things, and also Antoni Tapies, obviously the great kind of Spanish painter and sculptor and kind of philosopher. There's loads of works from him. So thanks for signing that off.
Whatever's under £100, you can do.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's the postage stamp to send it home. And just generally, the vibe is great. As I mentioned, the Spanish hospitality, it's wonderful. People walking around with flutes of champagne and beers. There's a young crowd here. And of course, there's a lot of wonderfully well-preserved ladies of a certain age in furs, despite the warming spring here in Madrid. So it's a pretty classy fair, and it's a great place to be. Madrid in spring, why not?
Sounds great from chilly London. Rob Bound, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Finally, on today's show, Fernando Augusto Pacheco is off in his native Brazil this week. But as it's Thursday, we will play a special countdown recorded for you on the menu. It's a tasty look at our favourite biscuits with Fernando and host Chiara Romella. Fernando begins with his choice for fifth place.
Brazil. See, it's not number one, but I still think Brazil produces the most amazing biscuits in the world. And to be honest, some people say biscuits, some people say bolacha in Brazil. There's all sorts of controversies about the name. But the number five, the type of biscuit I chose, I know it's very broad, but artisanal biscuits, or as we call it in Brazil, granny's cookies. Oh. You know, it's the artisanal that I love. And I chose, actually, I have an example for you. I bought in my latest trip to Brazil. It's called Chá das Cinco, or tea at 5 p.m. It's kind of a British connotation, but it's very simple and they're very small and it's made with sugar, butter, cinnamon. I think you should have a taste. This is just an example of those artisanal biscuits I'm telling you.
Okay, I'm going in. They're very strange. They almost look like dog biscuits.
And they're very light as well. They don't feel very heavy on your hand.
Now, this biscuit, it's delicious, but as far as biscuits go, it's on the simple side. It's got a tiny little bit of cinnamon. It's crispy, but it's tiny. It's such a weird kind of shell-shaped little bit.
But I like that, because then you eat like 20 of them and you don't feel full. I mean, you're very right. Brazilians are very simple the way they eat. Perhaps not too much filling on the biscuit. So that's why I said the list might be controversial.
Moving on, coming close to home.
Absolutely. And, you know, the British, first of all, they love talking about biscuits. And they love saying, is Jaffa Cakes a biscuit? Or, I'm not even entering this control. I don't have an opinion on that. So,
because we could have revealed here and for posterity, the definitive answer to this conundrum.
And the one I chose as well. In fact, you can go to Sainsbury's for 32p. And you're going to find a packet of one of the most delicious and very simple sweets from the British cuisine, which is the custard cream. I love it. Apparently, it's been invented in the UK in 1908. And one thing I noticed during my research, well, you can just look at a custard cream and see they're very, I don't know, very Victorian in their design. I think it's quite sweet.
Quite
literally. And I like the flavor as well. I think custard cream, the trick is don't have more than three. Unlike those cute Brazilian ones, they can actually be quite sweet. So just have a little bit with a cup of tea. I think that'll be great.
Number three.
We're heading to France now. And there's a specific brand, actually, that deserves our third spot. It's Epoilan. They make bread, amazing bread. I mean, they used to have actually a branch here in the UK, but I think nowadays their main market is in France. Every time I go to Paris, I go to Le Bon Marché and I buy this specific biscuit. And I have to say, I say I'm buying Paris, but their roots are in Normandy. But it's incredibly delicious and very chic as well, the packaging. Mulino Bianco is a number two. Of course, I think they're part of the Barilla group and they were invented in 1975. And it's funny because as an Italian, I'm sure you have nostalgia for these biscuits. But I think the brand was built on nostalgia because even the logo for Mulino Bianco is like an old mill and the names of their biscuits like abbracci, or which means hug, right?
Exactly.
So I chose Mulino Bianco and a specific one. I'll ask your favorite, but I want you to try this one. It's the Baiocchi Pistachio.
So Baiocchi are some of my favorites. I'm going to take one. You take another.
Yes, definitely. And can I tell you a secret?
Mm-hmm.
I have Baiocchi Pistachio every day.
No!
Every single day.
How do you stay so wonderfully fit?
Well, the trick is no more than three. You know, control yourself, but have it every day. It's kind of my late breakfast, so perhaps around 11 a.m. or something like that.
In Italy, people have biscuits for breakfast with coffee, with very milky coffee. So most Italian biscuits are extremely dry for most other countries' palates. And whenever I bring biscuits back from Italy, people are so disappointed because they open the packet and they just can't even swallow the things. But that's because that's not how you're meant to eat them. You know, they're big old packets and you open them in the morning and you dunk them into your milky coffee and you're off for the day. A sweet breakfast. I don't have it very much anymore, but it does give you a bit of a hit. Okay, finally, we have reached the very pinnacle, the top of our biscuit pyramid. There is one biscuit holding and balancing at the top of this precarious structure. What is it?
we're going to Japan.
Oh, I mean, nice.
I think it was kind of expected. But again, I'm choosing another brand in particular. And I have to thank our colleague, Kyoko. She's the one who introduced this brand to my life, Yokomoko. It's a fantastic Japanese confectioner from 1969. They have a selection of biscuits. They have the white chocolate one, which is amazing. But the one I decided to pick is called Cigar, which means cigarette in French, of course. It's amazing. And I'm sorry, Chiara, I might be a little bit repetitive here, but it's paper thin. It's simple. It's elegant. It's classy. It's not very show-offy in a way. It's very chic but understated at the same time. And they have different types of cigars. There's the chocolate version. There's the simple one, which of course is my favorite. And one with Earl Grey tea as well. It's quite a specific flavor, but I would recommend. I know they sell online, so if you really want, it might be a little bit expensive if you're outside Japan, but it's worth it. And again, it's the way the Japanese treat something so simple. Clearly, they were inspired by French patisserie, but in somehow they perfected in a way.
There's something about going to a department store in Tokyo and just seeing the confectionery aisle where everything is boxed up as if it was literal jewelry that is spectacular and just makes you appreciate the tiny intricacies and the perfection that goes into everything. So I think, despite everything and despite our respective patriotism, it's a deserved win.
Grazie.
That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chiara Ramella. You can hear more on this week's edition of The Menu wherever you get your podcasts or on our website. I won't hold it against them that they didn't include Scottish shortbread or, in fact, leave any of those biscuits in the studio for us. Just some crumbs. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Chris Chermak. Our researcher was Nyoma Ekwe. And our studio manager was Christy O'Grady. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.